Welcome back. Malcolm Gladwell is our guest. Bill Russell was about to think in public. What were you going to think, Bill?
Well, you know, we were talking earlier about cookbook, and I would expect, given the kinds of things you're talking about and the excellent analysis you do of laying out the various pieces and how those pieces operate and how they connect together, that corporate types would be all over you, that you would by now have set up your own consultancy and be charging somewhere between $1,000 and $1,500 an hour to go out and show people, step people through the cookbook. Has that happened?
Well, periodically people ask me to whether I would like to be a consultant, and I have always said no, because I have very little confidence in my own ability to, you know, go and turn around some flagging product or... it's not – yes, I do think there are lessons here for marketers, important ones. And I don't just mean corporate marketers. I mean anyone who is trying to get an idea across. At the same time, though, I think it's very important to point out that the vision of the world that I'm trying to push is a world that is far less predictable and more complex than the vision we're working with now. You know, you can go – we've been operating under this assumption in this country for the last 25 years that – the way to get your word out, the message across, is sign up a celebrity, have a multi-million-dollar budget, buy lots of airtime on TV, put up some billboards, and you win.
It's basically yell loud in the other
yell guys. Loud
Legend
than us. Yes. I'm saying, you know what? I don't believe it's about yelling loudest. I think it's about tapping into these much more subtle kind of social. And that's more complicated, you know? If you believe that the people who matter in America are the ones who make over $1 million a year and live in the biggest house, you know, I could make a phone call right now and someone could give you a list of all those people. We have those people on file. But if you believe that the people who really matter are the people who, you know, have this kind of specialized knowledge or the kinds of person who knows, you know, scores 120 on my connector test, we don't have those people on file. You know, they're, you know... the person who matters most in my life is someone who is unknown to the corporate marketing apparatus. You know, it's harder to find these people. You've got to do much more in-depth and
invariably you say it is that human contact that is the very best mm-hmm. sell.
It's, you know, if you want to sell me a computer, the single best thing you can do is to talk to my brother. My brother, you know, is a public school teacher living in a tiny town on Lake Huron. He's not on anyone's list, you know. But, you know, I happen to spend thousands of dollars, you know, a year on computer equipment, you know. You make
and
a lot of money.
And you influence people who then also do
sure.
that. Yeah.
But, you know, you got to find my brother to get to me. And
is there, and I don't really remember you addressing it directly, is integrity a part of this? I mean, is the kind of ability you're talking about, the various tools you've isolated, is that subject to cynical manipulation?
Well, integrity is a huge part of it. And one of the reasons why, if you think about mavens, you know, mavens have been studied by economists, this kind of person who knows everything, rather. And one of the things that's interesting about them is that they are not simply experts. We know who the experts are. The thing that sets a maven apart is they are an expert, but they are also driven by a very powerful altruistic streak. They want to share the knowledge. They want to help their friends. That's what they're all about, helping their friends. And one of the reasons their friends listen to them is that they know that it's altruistic. The maven isn't in it to make money. They're not in it. They're not part of some corporate scheme. They're not signing them up and getting bonus points or something. They're doing it, you know, why does my brother tell me about computers? Because he loves me. You know, which sounds
dumb. And he probably loves computers, too.
He loves computers, too. That sounds dumb. No. Think about computers as a kind of vehicle for brotherly love. But it is. That's just the way the world works.
Well, it's a manifestation of it.
Yeah, it's a manifestation of it.
And I guess part of what I hadn't really thought of it until you said that, so much of this is a dynamic process. It's mm-hmm. not, you know, you don't become a maven and stay a maven forever. If I start, you know, if I'm your maven, if your brother starts lying to you,
it's over.
Or if he stops paying attention even and falls
or
behind.
Or doesn't understand the whole thing that makes him work as my computer maven is he knows what I do and who I am and what I like, and he knows that I have a certain weakness for, you know, X, Y, and Z, and it's tailored information. He wouldn't give the same advice to my father. My father had different, you know, it's personalized.
It is striking how personal this all is, how intimate this all is. And again, in this time when people think, well, it's all too big and it's all overwhelming and I'm just a small cog and the wheels are too big and and this disaffection that's easy to feel. Mm-hmm. Everything you talk about is personal.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
That's great news.
It is. I mean, it says that despite a world that seems increasingly abstract and complex and impersonal, human beings react to that by burrowing out a little personal space and by building these kinds of very specialized human networks to rely on. I mean, you cannot defeat the human impulse to be surrounded by people that you love and respect. I mean, that is an absolutely impregnable human impulse.
Well, and it sort of flies in the face of the what did we call him in the '50s? The organization man.
Yeah.
It is just about 180 out from the organization person, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, it also does not. I mean, it seems to be very much not overtly cognitive. In terms of the social part of it, I mean, obviously the maven has, it has cognitive knowledge, and that's part of it. But even that, it would seem, it is also that visceral feel your brother has. Mm-hmm. Now, he probably does not maintain a checklist of this is what Malcolm likes, and he likes this and this, and doesn't go through and run a sort routine.
Yeah.
it is presumably emotional. It's in his early conscious, preconscious, subconscious.
Mm-hmm. Which is what, I mean, if you think about the choices that you make in a lot of these areas, you're not actually interested in the most rational choice. You're interested in the choice that feels right. And part of what makes something feel right is if it has the approval and endorsement of people that you respect. I mean, you could make someone who's some techie guy who works for Microsoft could sit down and make a complex argument that the little Sony Vaio that I bought, 6 months ago was actually not the best computer for my needs. But that's not as persuasive to me as someone who's close to me saying, you know what, I think that is the best one for your needs, Malcolm, because I know you. We're irrational creatures. We want that.
Well, it's interesting you say that because we talked last week with one of your colleagues about Microsoft and then a little go around there. And it's almost precise. What you just said is an almost precise description of their attitude about antitrust law.
Yeah.
And their role with respect to the computer, I mean, it is a purely rational, purely technical, relatively constrained perspective vis-a-vis essentially the government as a representative of the general public.
Mm-hmm.
But everything you're talking about could be taken into a domain that has nothing to do with the technical.
Mm-hmm.
This could be how you choose to send your kid to one school versus another,
mm-hmm.
whether you choose to live life one way or another.
Or it could be Paul Revere, which I find just...
Oh, it's a fabulous story. Will you do a short course on Paul Revere?
Yes. Well, I love this story because, I'm Canadian and was taught the story of Paul Revere from the English perspective.
Which is different.
Which is that he was a tax cheat and, part of a large group of ingrates living in New England who were unwilling to pay the full cost of... And I still hold to that. So he is not a hero to me. He's a hero to you. Just make that clear.
He's a hero in a context.
But
context being the issue here.
Yes. That story is told to school children as a story about a message. The British are coming, right? Incredible, creates this incredible epidemic, word of mouth epidemic across New England that morning. But that's not true because another guy leaves Boston, same time as Paul Revere, named William Dawes, goes in the other direction, saying the same thing, the British are coming, and no one listened to him. And no one from the towns William Dawes rode through met the British the next morning on the plains of, Lexington and wherever else. So clearly there was something else involved here. So what is it that made, the other something else is that Paul Revere was one of these personalities I'm talking about. He had the biggest Rolodex in New England. He was, this is a man.
1776.
If you go through the records of colonial Boston, you will see his name everywhere. He was on every committee. He was hanging out in every pub. He was a member of every card, game. Everybody knew this guy. They trusted him. When he goes out that night, he's not just randomly yelling, "The British are coming." He's knocking on the door of someone, and the person opens the door. It's 2 a.m, remember? They open the door, and it's like, oh, Paul Revere, you know, I know you. And he says the British are coming, and they listen to him. They don't listen to him if he's some nut. You know, William Dawes was some guy running through the night who you'd never seen or heard of. Paul Revere had that kind of social credibility. That's number one. Number two is there's a reason Paul Revere knows the British are coming, and that is this little kid overhears a British officer that morning. And what does the kid do with this piece of extraordinary gossip? He goes to Paul Revere. Paul Revere was the kind of guy you went to with gossip. Why? He's a maven. He was at the center of all of these information spy, you know, networks in colonial New England at that time. So there's nothing, there's no mystery to why that particular epidemic takes off. It takes off because we have one of these epidemic starters.
Well, going back to why I find this all so hopeful is there are people who want to organize their neighborhood to pick up the garbage. Mm-hmm. There are people who want to make sure that the preschool is a better place. There are people who want their sorority to thrive and do bake sales. All of this stuff feels very personal. This feels doable. This feels ordinary.
Yeah.
But you've taken it to the extraordinary.
Oh, it's... you guys are very nice. I should hire you. And would you like to go on the road?
I would, actually. But no, I'm not going to do that. This is Malcolm Gladwell, with whom we are not going on the road, but we're glad that the road has come to you. We'll be back in just a moment for a couple more minutes with him here at The New Yorker. Please be with us when we return.